But first to a thought-provoking, if slightly tricky discussion I was involved in last year at the National Museum of Australia. How do Indigenous people negotiate the path between their traditions and their place in the modern world? It was a good broad panel. It hailed from Canada, America, New Zealand and Australia. And this is an edited version of the discussion held in the lovely foyer of the museum overlooking the Molonglo River.
Now, the museum kicked off a three-day conference today called New Encounters, Communities, Collections and Museums, to coincide with the Encounters exhibition, revealing stories of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander objects from the British Museum. Now, I actually saw the original exhibition in London last year, and I know it's been significantly reconfigured here, but I just can't tell you how I'm delighted I am to be here, that it's here and I am too. Joining me is a very distinguished panel of speakers, and we'll be exploring really a lot of things, but how First Nations people around the world think of themselves these days, how they negotiate their identities in their respective nations, and their relationships to the kinds of collections that are here, and why that can be a very vexed issue, but also full of promise. And to the wider community, how do these collections, the collections that are on display in this New Encounters exhibition, how do these collections and identities of the traditional pasts convey to us all a way of getting into the contemporary future? So that's how I'm going to try to navigate this. There's a lot to explore. And let me introduce our panel very quickly. Richard West, Paul Tapsell, Dawn Casey, Richard Lewaki and David Garno. Would you welcome them all, please? Now, just so we hear all voices, I hate panels where you never hear somebody sort of for 20 minutes in. We're going to hear everybody. Just answer in about 2 minutes. How do they each consider that First Nations people negotiate the path between tradition and the future? What do you keep and what do you leave behind? It's such a big question. And I'll introduce each panellist in detail as we go. First to you, Richard West. You're a founding director and director emeritus of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian and president and CEO of the AUTRI, National Center of the American West, and you're based in LA. You're a citizen of the Cheyenne Arapaho Nation of Oklahoma and a member of the Society of Southern Cheyenne Peace Chiefs. So how do you answer that question? What do you discard? What do you keep?
Well, I don't think you discard much of anything. And the reason I feel that way is because we look at things like that as being cyclical, not along a straight line with a beginning point and an end point. And so that which we do now, and we engage the future just like everybody else, in that is embedded lots of things from our past. And so that is the way we look at it. And I think that any institution attempting to interpret Native life and culture is duty-bound to do the same thing, which is to say, look at Native peoples as existing across a spectrum of time that has a deep past, goes right up to the present, acknowledge that they know something about their own past which we should listen to, and be supportive of the efforts of Indigenous people to do precisely that.
Even if, and I'll come back to that, even if the ethic of the institution that's hosting it may not have quite that set of qualities.
Well, then the effort becomes one of through a constructive engagement to move them to that same position.
Now, Dawn Casey, you were the founding director here of the National Museum. You've also been at the WA Museum, my home state, and the Powerhouse, and you're a descendant of the Tagalog clan from North Queensland. What are your views on this dance, I suppose, if I can put it like that?
The issues around our First Nations people in Australia that lend itself strongly to what Rick has just said is that we are still finding out information about our collections, our material culture, our languages. It's still unfolding for us because there was much lost during colonisation and the subsequent long silence on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country. So it's very hard to discard something that you're still not aware of.
David, you're an artist, you're a curator and an academic from the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, in Canada, And you've recently co-curated an exhibition called Moving Forward, Never Forgetting. So obviously something very high in your thoughts at the moment. So I'm just intrigued by how you think about this.
It's interesting. So I'm Métis from the prairies of Canada. And about 8 years ago, I discovered that I was Indigenous. And what I mean by that, and it was here in Australia. So as a Métis person, I'm an Aboriginal person recognized by the Canadian government along with First Nations and Inuit people. But 8 years ago, the Canada Council brought a group of Indigenous artists to Australia, and we became Indigenous. And what that means is it's a new class of people who are able to travel around. So they're Aboriginal people who recognize that they have something in common with the Aboriginal people in other countries. So I became Indigenous. And what does it mean? It means that I have to be very careful not to lose my Aboriginality and my Métis-ness. So I'm going to agree. I think we're going to agree with everybody on this panel.
Wait till I get started. Yeah. Yes.
But what it means is that as a Métis person at home, you know, I have to be very conscious about the land, the territory, and the people that I am a part of. And when I move to a place like Australia, I have to remember not to forget those people, and that informs my time. And as was mentioned, you know, time is not a linear thing, it's more like a spiral, and we keep revisiting ourselves like we revisit the seasons. And so what to discard, you'll only come across it again later on in memory or in fact. Yeah. So these objects, these belongings in the museum remind us. So when I go to this exhibition, I don't have the memories of the people in them, but I'm reminded of the continuity of cultures that are all around the world.
I've just got to take you up. So you think this word Indigenous for you is quite a new thing.
Right. With a capital I. With a little I, it just means something that's of that place.
An adjective, but right. You're saying it's something
but
much
But the capital
more.
I, Indigenous, is quite different. It's a consciousness that we all share collectively, and we're figuring it out as we go along.
Okay, that's very interesting. Now, Richard Lewaki, you're the former governor of the Pueblo Nation, and a member of the Laguna Tribe in New Mexico. You're also a board member of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. So you've absorbed yourself thoroughly, I would have thought. So what's your view?
Well, you know, in my mind, you know, as I've served as a governor and many of us that are parents and leaders and whatnot, grandparents in our communities, in our respective community, we're taught about, as we refer to one another, Wahanos Ish, human spirit. In everyday life, we say hano, just people. But in reality, we're all spirits. So in that world of spirituality, what brought us here allows us to exist today, but will allow us to continue into the future. We're going to always have that connection. And we don't have the authority to throw anything or anyone away. They're not objects. They're beings. Well, I'm here, and yeah, as they tell us, that's how everything has a purpose.
Did you always think like this, or is this something that you've come to? Because you came from the IT world, didn't you, originally? I don't mean you came from it, but you worked in it. So, you know, I think... that's right. Well, I mean, my gosh, that's a contrast with how you're speaking now.
In my world, that's my upbringing, that's my grooming. My grandparents raised me, so I got to hang out with all the old folks. But it was a rich upbringing because the grooming really was about those things that the creators bestowed us with, you know.
All right. Well, look, thank you. Can I just ask you to draw a small line on that for a moment? Because Paul Tapsell, I want to hear how you speak from across the ditch. You're professor and chair of Maori Studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand. And part of your research interest is the role of cultural heritage in museums. So you must have really absorbed yourself in this.
Oh, thank you, Geraldine. How can you discard what you never owned?
What you never owned.
Exactly. And this is a philosophical underpinning, for our people at least, in that we belong to our ancestors, that everything which materializes from Mother Earth returns to Mother Earth, even our own being. So we are, in a way, we are temporary, but we are part of a chain of events or a genealogy of beliefs and practices and moments that reach back to the singularity that created the universe, to go to our Western side of thinking. for us, back to Rangi and Papa, Earth Mother and Sky Father coming together. And we are the manifestation in consciousness right now.
So when you're navigating this modern, you know, you did, I've done a lot of competitive sport in your time.
You've been doing your research.
Yes, small bits. So I just wonder, I mean, that was foot in one world, obviously, which you loved by the sound of it. But did that inform you then? Did that sort of attitude about a sort of incredible circularity and belonging to the past, or did you lay that aside for a while?
It's always been there. And within the competitive sport space, it's something that reminds you when you are in an extreme sport and death could happen at any moment. Mm. Just the gift of being able to compete, being able to engage the world. And perhaps on moments where you did silly things, realizing that someone, something, a spirit has watched over you and you're here today. But it's temporary. And today will come to an end. And this is part of the teachings of my people, is that, you know, your birth is part of a cycle of life, and you will reintegrate back into the landscape of your ancestors. You will become the bones of Mother Earth.
So when you see objects such as we've seen here today at this wonderful exhibition, how does that play to you then in this sort of quest to marry the two, you know, to get a sense of serenity that you're displaying now? Do the objects matter?
Well, if the objects are the ancestors.
The objects are the ancestors.
It matters very much, because especially if those ancestors have been ripped away from country, and they are the portals back into relinking today's generation to the values and the principles and the philosophies of the past generation, these are the things that must carry us forward. But if they have been recast within a museum context outside their original meaning, then in a way they're becoming orphans, like our children are growing up in cities, separated from their grandparents' knowledge.
Do you see it like that, Dawn?
I haven't been brought up to see them as beings, but as being very, very important, connecting us to our ancestors. Mm.
This is the dilemma, because like when I saw that Gweigl shield with the bullet hole in it in the British Museum, I cried. I mean, I knew the story, but it made the most powerful impression on me. Now, you might say, well, God, you know, it'd take you that long to get that impression, but it did. It did make a powerful impression on me and opened me up more to the wider story. So if that hadn't been there doing that, I would have missed that. Isn't that worth holding on to about the collection of objects?
It's a very vexed question, that. I think what's truly moving about that...
Maybe you should just explain to people that this is a fabulous shield from a Gweigl man who met Captain Cook and at Botany Bay on the 29th of April in 1770, when shots were fired, and this amazing piece of artefact of the very earliest encounters, which I had never seen before.
And I'll go to my First Nations interpretation soon on it. And I think what's very interesting from that perspective, it's a wonderful tool as a museum director and a curator to show that to, for those people who want to know more, who want to better understand colonisation of this country, for the descendants of the people who made that shield, it means something completely different to First Nations people. It is a part of them, and hearing, you know, seeing that their great-grandfather got shot. So it's two completely different meanings. And it was interesting your comment earlier on about, which was very well handled in terms of museums, they wouldn't have been protected had they not been looked after by museums. Well, had that not been the case, I would suggest that we would be continuing to make spears and evolving, so it wouldn't be a big issue. But it is true that there were tools that were used and they would have deteriorated out there, but that's not the case in terms of people have looked after them in some cases. And in other cases, there's concerns about the toxic material and chemicals that were used to restore and maintain which are beings to some people and living objects. So I think it's very complex, and I think wherever possible they should be returned to community, or there should be museums or, you know, cultural centres, keeping places where people can have access to their material culture.
How do you think about this in the US, Richard?
I can sort of cut to the chase on this by just looking briefly at the federal repatriation laws that were enacted about a quarter of a century ago in the U.S. And basically what they did with respect to the kinds of objects that we're talking about, for the most part, is that they required the repatriation after due process of certain categories of objects to Native communities, to contemporary Native communities. And the judgment was simply made by the United States Congress that those kinds of materials, which were essential to contemporary ceremonial practice, should never have left the communities in the first instance. There is this notion, and here's what I think the rub is, without getting too theoretical about it. There is a conception somehow of the museum sometimes as being a universal instrument, where objects somehow that may be linked up historically to specific communities, in the case of the people who are surrounding you today, indigenous communities, that somehow become, quote, universal, and they transcend those communities and they go somewhere else in universal museums. I think the judgment that has been made in the United States is that that is not the case, where you are talking about living communities, living indigenous communities, yes, whose very survival as cultures of the future depends upon association with these kinds of objects. That's where they should be. Now, that kind of recognition does not prohibit necessarily, if it belongs to a community, you're seeing it in museums. Sometimes it will, depending upon the kind of object it is. But it is simply a trade-off which is made. And I think that we're looking at a context where, through colonization, which happened here, which happened in the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where much of this cultural patrimony was removed from the tribe and from the Native community, it left them in a very, very challenged position. And yet they are still here. It's not that they are simply some ethnographic remnant of the past that is gone. And so repatriation laws were based upon that. And so I think that there's lots of in-between territory where museums and communities can work with one another about this kind of thing. But it begins with an acceptance, fundamentally at the beginning of the process, that there are simply some things that sit in museum communities that should be elsewhere.
So let's say, for instance, that, because I mean, there's been a great deal of cooperation, as I understand it, with the National Museum of Australia, with living communities. That's been a very important sort of emphasis. Mm-hmm. So let's say they say, well, I don't want to get too stuck on whether they should go back and forth to the British Museum, but let's say there isn't a facility in, say, Broome in Western Australia, for the sake of argument, to go back, for something to go back there, so that by sending it back, there's a risk, even to the living community you're describing. You're saying this is sort of a liminal space, is it? And
yeah, well,
you're happy with that?
Surely, I understand that. But I think that is where museums that hold such material have a responsible to work in creative ways with existing contemporary and living communities, which is to say, the tribes and communities are the first people to admit sometimes that they cannot hold this material because they don't have the facilities.
Did they think they were capable?
Yes.
Right.
And what happened at the National Museum of the American Indian was that we took what seemed to me an eminently logical step, which is to say that, contrary to what was then museum practice, which is that you never have an object in your collection to which you do not have legal title, we simply changed the policy and we said, under certain circumstances, we will hold that material if that is helpful to the contemporary community, and that even when we have formally transferred title to them. And my point is,
loan from them to you.
Yes. Yes. Right. And so all I'm saying is that there is lots of middle territory here, which I think can be explored, and which was really explored in connection with the Encounters exhibit in terms of how you consult and you mediate these kinds of things. But it does begin with a proposition that at some point at the very beginning, one simply has to accept, and that is the institution that holds the collection sometime, that it is something that will be returned. even if it may sit, as you're pointing out, in the museum. And that's what was done by the United States Congress when they were enacting the repatriation laws.
Within a dealing context, use Auckland's museum as an example, which was former Director Māori there. One of the things we did was, first and foremost, work out what the trajectory was of the ancestor, how this heritage object arrived in the museum, and by distinguishing that, then you could work out what was the best step forward in terms of what Rick's talking about. So there were taonga ancestors that arrived there by gift, then there are those that arrived that were purchased, then there are those that arrived that were on loan, and then there are those that arrived inappropriately. Mm. The best thing that occurred out of our period of during that time was we would go to the communities before they even knew that we were holding inappropriately acquired taonga and offer to return them and enter into a relationship. And immediately this relationship that develops from that is out of that communication and out of an understanding that the museum can act as a holding place. Literally, all of our human remains that were there, we had over 1,000 human remains during my time, they were all signed back to the communities. They've not all returned home, but
why not?
Because the communities will be ready when they're ready to receive home those ancestors. And it's not something you just put in the back of a truck and drop it off. Mm. There's a lot of discussion that has to go around, not least these ancestors have been sitting on a landscape of another tribe for almost 100 or 150 years. So a lot of discussion around the healing of the local tribe in which the Auckland Museum sat, and discussions with the source community from which the Auckland Museum had taken inappropriately these ancestral remains and had traded worldwide. These were discussions that must occur. And out of that has come these amazing relationships that will be cross-generational even after the remains, after these ancestors have gone home.
Let me ask you all about whether the young people of your various communities are aware of this really quite profound conversation that you're describing. I mean, because museums, you know, and young people usually, that they don't go together, but you're describing an ability to connect in ways that obviously are incredibly, you know, just simply vital to you all. Do you think it's making a difference to young people's sense of identification? What do you think, David, in Canada?
Canada, as many other places, there's a great effort to make these spaces into educational institutions, not just repositories for these objects. That's essential. What we've learned, you mentioned moving forward, never forgetting, is that we actually hired Indigenous people to be story keepers in our exhibition. So what happened was you would go into the exhibition and the story keepers would be actually very assertive and come and ask if you had questions. And if you didn't, they would tell you the questions you ought to have. And it was really a lively discussion, and students, children like that kind of encounter because, you know, the museum is set up, I say, as a necropolis, you know, this dead city. And when children come in, they are told that they've got some oils on their hands and that if they touch things, it'll destroy the past and the future. And so they're very quiet. So finding ways through another human intermediary to break that down a little bit and so they can bring the stories to life is very important.
Does it matter if they do destroy the objects?
Well, I've already told you, it's okay. There are some objects that you can't, okay, because the object is not the thing itself ever. It's always its interconnectedness. The way it's trained is everything's connected, right? So why would we sever that relationship with children, the next generation? It's the essential project that we have to be engaged in. And as already been mentioned, we have failed. We have failed culturally in so many ways, but part of it is, I don't know what it's like here, but many generations are learning these things as we go along. And that reconnection is central, and so we feel a great duty to work with children to have them connect as well.
How does it work in the Pueblo Nation, would you say, Richard?
Well, you know, we have 19 Pueblos in New Mexico, and I can't speak for all of them. I can speak for my Pueblo, but to not make things so sacred that we destroy, you know, because as an example, we have our canes. And that cane resembles and symbolizes our ability to self-govern for sovereignty. So the first cane that we have was given to us by the Spanish crown in 1620. The second cane we have is from the Mexican government, and that was given to us in 1820, right before the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, that basically when the ended the Mexican-American War. And then the last cane we have is the Abraham Lincoln cane. So in 1863, Abraham Lincoln gave us canes, and so the leadership over all these years have handed it down. And so whoever the governor is, you know, they carry this cane. I mean, it's kind of our badge, if you will, of our authority. There's been leaders in the past that say, don't touch it to the kids, don't touch it. But in my mind, the way I see it is, absolutely touch it. Those are your grandparents. Those are all that came before us. So that's what I mean, don't make it so sacred that the children can't participate.
Maybe that's a good segue to my final question, really. It's amazing how much time has gone by. But I wonder, if I did ask you all, what object, by way of investing a story to it, mattered such that you would do almost anything to have it in your collection, what would you say, Dawn?
Well, I've been raised, because we didn't have any objects, because our parents were removed, and all of the story, which is so similar right across our First Nations people. But what was instilled in me and my brothers and sister was, they didn't use the word ethic, but be highly ethical, transparent, and you have a responsibility to other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in everything you do. And that was from when you were a child, this was just placed on you. So the issue for me was seeing, as I grew up and taking on more responsibility for either finding a house for my parents from the age of 12 to other issues about making sure I could speak up at the school for what sort of education my brothers had to have or I had to have, was the need for structural changes. So what I would love to have in my museum is the actual piece of legislation that was handled by Gough Whitlam and our people on the Racial Discrimination Act, because it gave us the formal recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the First Nations people in this country.
Good. Okay, great, right. Now, I know David is going to have a very interesting circular argument about about this that he's going to hurl back at me. What
well,
would you
I'm going to tell you a story before my smart-ass answer.
Yes.
And I was just thinking about the difference between Aboriginal and Indigenous, and I just remembered a story. There were some Zen monks who came to my small city in Saskatchewan, and the first thing they did is they went looking for elders at the Paiapot Reserve, which is nearby. And they were painting their sand mandala in the gallery, and I was asking the head guy, Sam, I forgot his name now, and I said, well, now why did you go to the elders? Why did you go to the First Nations people? And he said, well, here's how it works. We travel all around the world, and we go to the elders first. And if we agree on things, the nature of the universe, if we agree, that's true. If we disagree, that's cultural.
Oh, that's very cute.
And it was profound to me. That's why you see, here we are gathering Indigenous people. The Aboriginal is political. We won't agree. But the Indigenous, this is freedom, this free area where we'll all agree. Now my real answer, of course, we want the land back. That will be our museum.
Thank you very much. Now, Richard, how would you answer?
I would like to see in a museum a place to have the conversation about the object of purpose. We create objects
as a means to an end.
As a means to an end.
Mm. Paul?
It's a little perplexing, your question. And I probably would recast it and say, well, what is the object of my museum? And it would be the children. And the young people need to reconnect, especially those who have grown up away from our tribal region, away from the privilege I had of accessing the stories of my old people. How can we re-engage them with those stories and reconnect their sense of belonging and identity back into the landscape of their ancestors, of Earth Mother, so they have a security of heart again, hope and faith that they do belong in this world.
Richard?
Well, I'll be a little bit more literal in answering your question, but hopefully there'll be some poetics to it too. It's a personal story. When I was a youngster, my father, who's the native side of my family, my mom was white, took us to see the collection of the High Foundation Museum of the American Indian in New York. And my dad talked to us along the way as to why he was taking us there. And he said he wanted us to see what was the most remarkable assemblage of Cheyenne material he knew of. That happened to be the collection which I oversaw. So there was a very personal tie to it. But I remember that visit and the objects that, I mean, I love all Cheyenne regalia. If I do say so, it is some of the most beautiful on the face of the earth. But what my eye fastened on was a shield. And let me explain why shields are of particular importance to me. It is both literal, but it is metaphorical too. Shields, at least as made by Cheyennes, and I'm sure this was true with others, were a very personal item. It was both his personal statement, and yet it had to do with his connection with the community. So it wasn't just to defend him personally, but it was to defend the Native community. So here you have a connection between individual and community that for me is extremely important. And it has kind of remained my favorite object, quite frankly, because in taking on the leadership initially of the National Museum of the American Indian, I felt that museums themselves, who had this kind of cultural patrimony sitting within their four walls, should undertake that in a metaphorical way, because they should try to protect those objects, not just as a museum, but because of their powerful connections with living cultures who still relied upon connections with those objects.
Well, that's a lovely answer, I must say. It's straddling the two needs very beautifully. Thank you. I'm sorry we have to go, but look, it's very rich, as you can see, this debate, and we're going to keep having it. And I'd like you to thank Richard Luwaki, David Garno, Richard West, Dawn Casey and Paul Tapsell. Thank you very much indeed. Now, we did take some questions from the floor, and I'd like to bring you a couple of those, as I think they're worth listening to again.
Chris Burke, I'm a Gamilaroi fella, and what I wanted to know from the panel, given the power of these objects and their place in our Indigenous world, what is the opportunity for them to exert an effect upon the non-Indigenous world, which for we Australians is so important, given that outnumbers us 20-1 at least? And is there an opportunity here for objects to be part of our or at least my vision of what reconciliation is about? Is it about enabling non-Indigenous Australians to be able to draw into that 40,000 years of Indigenous history and say it's part of their story too?
Paul.
Just really quickly, I'm not suggesting we're going to hell in a handbag, but the power of the object is in it being able to be reproduced across generations. And the object actually is utilitarian, and it's something that has become turned into a work of art, perhaps. But I think, finally, a time to tell a story. My auntie, I remember watching her, and she was doing traditional weaving, and one of my nieces came up and said, "Auntie, why are you doing that?" "You know, because we can buy clothes down at Kmart." And she just turned around, "Well, you'll never know when the lights are going to go out."
Cute. Very nice. David.
I don't use the word reconciliation, because reconciliation assumes that there was an original conciliation event that happened, whether it's a treaty or whatever it was. So I use the word conciliation. We're still in this conciliatory mode. And if you want to be conciliatory, you know, smile at youth who are Indigenous, whether you're Indigenous or not. Let them know that they are not invisible. Come to these exhibitions. This is an incredible exhibition. It's phenomenal to me. But it isn't just the objects. It's also the curation. It's the building. It's the fact that all these people, all you people, come here. That's conciliation. It means you're interested. People are interested. They want to not get over things. They want to engage, encounter each other.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Richard, you mentioned legislation in terms of repatriation of objects back to the American Indians. And what we have after 200 years, the spirits of our ancestors have finally come to Australian soil, not necessarily to their country. And now we have further enforcement of law to ensure that those spirits are going to go back once again across the waters back to London. Sorry, I didn't say my name. I am Henrietta Murray. I'm a Gima Wallaba Yidindji woman and associate professor with Central Queensland University. Thank you.
Okay, so at the moment, I don't know the politics of all of this, but at the moment that is true. These are on loan from the British Museum. Now, I know there's all sorts of interesting shenanigans about how long they're going to be loaned, but in theory, at the end of this, they go back.
Was it this Richard or that?
I think it was that Richard. I think it was Richard, yeah.
I think it was you.
I think
so. Okay. Well, I think that those, I understand the dilemma. At the NMAI, we dealt with our own museums. We had legislation by which we had to abide. I know that there are different viewpoints on this in some of the internet, in some of the museums that sit in Europe, to be very candid about it. And we dealt with that repeatedly. But I would say, without presuming to know the answer to the specific question that was asked about objects that are in this, that even in Europe, I think there is beginning to be movement.
So they're far tougher, they're far more hardline, are they?
They have, and it happened with respect to the Maori in particular.
Right.
It took an act, if you can believe it, of the French Assembly to get the material returned because they had to overturn a law that prohibited them from doing that. So there is territory to be covered. But I know, for example, that lots of some of the material and cultural patrimony that is most valuable to some of the tribes in the United States still sits not in our own museums, but in Europe. And again, there is some middle territory here, and we've explored that middle territory in this exhibit because those objects have been loaned. But there still is the ultimate question that will have to be dealt with at some point. And so that is still to be done. And I understand why the question is asked, because they have come this close. Our attitudes toward our need for them have not changed, I think this person is saying. And so at some point, the question about whether they continue not to be repatriated from some of those museums will persist.
And that was Richard West ending the question time at the National Museum of Australia in Canberra, where an Encounters conference was held in March last year. I invite you to go to our website if you'd like to find out more about the panellists, because that was just a snapshot of their activities.